On behalf of the World Affairs Council, it's my pleasure to moderate this discussion tonight and to first introduce our three distinguished guests. You should have bios available that describe their backgrounds in greater detail, so what I'm going to say about them is very brief and telegraphic. But Pradeep Chibber is the chair of India Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He specializes in research on party systems, party aggregation, and the politics of India. So we're going to get him to help us decipher the meaning of the most recent parliamentary elections. Sundar Ramaswamy, who's seated immediately to Pradeep's left, is the president of the Monterey Institute of International Studies and also serves as Distinguished University Professor of International Economics. It's worth noting that he is a visiting professor at the Madras School of Economics, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I have to also acknowledge his role as a trustee of the Asia Foundation and actually the vice chairman of our board, so he's my boss. So I give particular weight to everything that that Sundar has to say. And then finally, on our to Sundar's left is Thomas Hansen, who's professor of South Asian Studies and Anthropology, and he's the director of the Center for South Asia at Stanford University. He's the author of several books on social, religious conflict and Indian democracy. So we couldn't ask for a more distinguished, well-informed, and thoughtful panel to help guide us in understanding the meaning of the most recent elections. And I'd like to invite this audience to please welcome our three distinguished panelists. This past May, India completed the largest democratic election in the world. More than 554 million Indian voters exercised their franchise. And the incumbent Indian National Congress Party, which had held power for the majority of India's post-colonial history, lost badly to Narendra Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party. Surprisingly, the BJP gained a sufficient number of seats to form a government without coalition partners. And indeed, some of India's regional parties saw their influence significantly eroded as they lost ground and lost seats to the BJP. What does this election mean in terms of the changing Indian political landscape? And what can we expect from India's new leadership as far as the country's economic and foreign policy agenda? Finally, given the BJP's history as a Hindu nationalist party and Mr. Modi's controversial role in handling communal violence in Gujarat, what are the implications of lingering religious and ethnic tensions in this vast democracy? We will delve more deeply into these and other issues in the coming hour. Let's begin by discussing the political meaning of this historic election and turn first to Pradeep Chibber to put it into context. Pradeep, from your perspective, what are the most significant takeaways from this year's parliamentary elections? Does Mr. Modi's victory signal a permanent shift in the Indian electorate, or was it a short-term reaction to Congress's lackluster performance and power? And where does this leave Congress as a viable opposition party?
Let me begin by saying that Indian elections, on the one hand, seem amazingly complicated, but they're very easy to understand. And unfortunately, I don't have much time to explain why they're so easy. It takes about 5 minutes, and that's all I have. But Indian elections are remarkably easy to understand. But what is unique about these elections is, first, two things, which we well know, is that the BJP got a mandate. And it's a mandate because, for a couple of reasons. First, the BJP did exceedingly well in many parts of the country where it had never done well before. That is the first thing. Second, the BJP managed to get support from all kinds of social groups. It got support from the so-called Dalits. It got more votes from Dalits or the former scheduled castes than even the Congress Party. It got more as it retained its supports among the upper the elite and the upper castes of Indian society. It got more support among the other backward castes. So in other words, it actually has done remarkably well. Modi has managed to stitch together a rather large coalition, which is unprecedented. How he's managed to do it and how permanent it is something I'll talk about very briefly. The other thing that was remarkable about this election was a couple of things. First, this election witnessed the highest turnout ever seen in Indian elections. Now, as a sidebar, whether I trust the Election Commission data on turnout or not is a separate matter. But for the moment, taking that data for at its face value, I think the turnout was the highest ever. And what we find was really remarkable about the turnout is that in areas where the turnout went up by more than 15%, the BJP won 90% of the seats. Where the turnout went up by more than 10%, the BJP won 80% of the seats. And where turnout did not go up, the BJP actually won 40 or only 30% of the seats. So there was something going on in the areas where turnout increased. And what was happening in those areas was that the BJP managed to run an exceptionally well-orchestrated campaign on the ground. There are pretty well-established stories going around the world, stories going around India, where the party managed to get lots of people enthused and ready to mobilize votes for the party. The big question is, are these vote mobilizers, as I would like to call them just for the moment, are they partisan? Do they stay with the party? Or are they actually in it for the moment? From the data I've seen, these are short-term supporters of the BJP. In other words, a large number of what we call the vote mobilizers who helped increase turnout in India are doing it for two reasons. One, they were doing it for the leader. And two, very clearly, they also were doing it because they think that the BJP is the winning party. In other words, they were hitching their bandwagon to a winning party. So if these vote mobilizers are important because of this increased turnout, it becomes quite clear that as long as Mr. Modi and the BJP can hold on to these vote mobilizers, they can ensure victory in the coming election as well. But can they do so or can they not do so? And to answer that question, I'll turn to the second reason why the BJP did really well. And the BJP did really well largely because, and it's pretty well established, because of Mr. Modi's appeal. And I think I'd like to hear what Thomas Hansen has to say on this, but I don't think his appeal was charismatic in the sense of the appeal of somebody like an Indira Gandhi or a Jawaharlal Nehru. He projected himself as somebody who can solve problems and somebody who can be decisive and somebody who matters, who can actually get things done. Now, it's a far deeper question and something I'm willing to talk about at length. Why is it that Indian elections are so centered around leaders? Why is it that people can think that a leader can come and solve the problems of an exceedingly complex and large country? No one individual has ever solved all the myriad governance problems of a billion plus people. Yes. But somehow there's a belief that this can happen, and Modi projected himself as a person who can actually do that. So I think his success is largely because of his ability to present himself as a decisive leader. The third thing he did, which surprised me when I looked at the data, was he managed to stitch together a coalition of two kinds of people. One is the well-known established social conservatives, mostly the upper castes and the upper other backward castes, but he also managed to get a lot of people who were economic conservatives onto the side of the BJP. They actually deserted the Congress. And the BJP made massive inroads into rural areas. So the BJP has done exceptionally well. But I don't think, like a lot of people may be thinking, that this is any permanent shift. I think this is a five-year cycle. I think its success is somewhat temporary and somewhat tempered by the fact that he's done really well. The BJP has done really well in some areas. I think that success is not going to be repeated. I will go out on a limb. It's going to be difficult. And I can talk about why. And finally, of course, because of the role of these vote mobilizers, we find that they're not going to be supporting Mr. Modi if he's not going to win. Finally, what about the Congress Party? The other extreme, the Congress Party lost its deposit. If you don't get more than 1/6 of the vote, you actually lose your deposit. In other words, you pay 25,000 rupees to contest an election. You have to give it to the Election Commission. The darling of the Silicon Valley, the Aam Aadmi Party, lost deposit in 400 seats. So the Congress shouldn't feel particularly bad. But they lost their deposit in 179 seats. which is unbelievable. In 105 seats, the Congress got less than 5% of the vote. So the Congress's decimation is almost complete. There are six states in which provide 205 seats out of the 540 to the Indian Parliament, but the Congress has not been in power for 25 years. So I think the chance of the Congress regaining, making a comeback, are quite frankly difficult. However, the big question everybody asks is, what about the dynasty? I'm sorry, but the dynasty is here to stay for very good reasons. The Congress has to hold together three different kinds of people. It has to hold together state leaders, and it has to hold together a national coterie, and it has to hold together some local level notables as well. And the dynasty is the only available option for the Congress party at the moment to hold together these diverse, three very diverse groups. We'd like to think that maybe power should be devolved to somebody else, as we were talking earlier, but the moment you devolve power to somebody else, you know what's going to happen, right? Everybody else thinks, I should be the prime minister, why this person? So the dynasty becomes the least of the worst options, you know, the safest of the last options. So finally, and I'll conclude by saying this, so what is going to happen in the coming years as far as the elections are concerned? I think the BJP will try to increase its ability to increase its reach across the nation. I think the appointment of Mr. Amit Shah as the party president is an effort in that direction, because he ran a very successful campaign for the BJP in UP, despite his you know, questions about his past. He did a pretty good job organizing this party on the ground. But to me, most importantly, what I think the BJP is going to try and do is actually go after the dynasty. Mm. And the reason they need to do that is, if they go after the dynasty, then the Congress will actually wither away. Mm. And then the BJP can take the position, I'm going out on a limb, BJP can take the position the Congress had, which is, to pardon my use of political science terminology, in any pairwise comparison, the BJP will come out as a party people want to govern India, much as the Congress was. Collectively, the Congress never had 50% of the vote, ever, right? So the opposition always had more votes than the Congress, but nobody could beat the Congress in a one-to-one comparison as the party that would run the country. And I think the BJP would like to do that, and for it to do that, it actually has to go for the dynasty. So I think the high-level politics isn't going to get much more interesting in the coming years. But that's just a going out on a limb.
Thank you so much, Professor Pradeep Chhibber. I think you've contradicted your notion that you can make Indian elections simple just by your last comments about the pairwise comparison. I think it's very, very interesting. Let's turn now to the economy, which, after all, was the major issue on which Mr. Modi campaigned. Professor Sundar Ramaswamy, can the new prime minister do for India what he did for Gujarat in terms of attracting investment and creating jobs? Or, as a recent CNN economic commentator asked, can Modi help India get its mojo back?
Thank you, David, and thank you to the World Affairs Council. It's great to see this incredible turnout and an interest in everything to do with what's going on in India. I'll try and keep my remarks fairly brief, to about less than 5 minutes, so that we can have more of an exchange once everyone else gets to speak. As an economist and as a development economist, I think it is, building up on what Pradeep said, I think it was a vote both in terms of how the UPA, the previous government, had not done much in the last 5 years, I would say, along with a very positive hope that Modi would be able to do at the national stage what he was able to do in Gujarat over 10 years and 3 terms as chief minister. And at some level, you know, it's the most fascinating question for me, not just as a person who grew up there, but as a development economist, because like many facets of India, the economy is frustrating, challenging, but also fascinating in terms of its opportunities, in terms of its constraints, in terms of the dreams and aspirations of one-sixth of the world's humanity is in that subcontinent. And so how India goes is very critical, not just for that population, but I think it has ramifications in some ways. So I'm hoping that he succeeds at some level. I think we all should, because you know, if you think about the last 20 years when the Indian economy started to open up and trying to be satisfy the demands of the people, I think it was on a tear, on a very upward trajectory for the most part in terms of growth-oriented economics and focus on markets and away from the socialist license Raj and all of that. And that was the decade of the 90s, so much so that I think we sort of fell into that hyperbole, and it didn't help that somebody from Goldman Sachs coined the BRICS and you know, tied the Indian fortunes to Brazil, Russia, China, and sort of we believed our own press that somehow that was going to continue until we made some real tough choices, which we didn't. The UPA government never really did in the second iteration. And so then the growth started to stumble. And in some ways, I think the two lessons that come out of this elections is Modi's focus on markets and Modi's focus on governance rather than the size of the government. So everything he's trying to do in the budget that just got released in terms of empowering the federal structure to give back more money to the states to actually implement policy so that everything is not done from the center in New Delhi, but actually development is more devolved because India still is sort of this unitary in spirit and federal in structure, and I think that's an interesting focus. And I think his reflexive nature, as when he was chief minister of Gujarat, that he believed in the success of markets and businesses, and government should be somewhat smaller and more effective and focuses much more on governance. I mean, as any of you who have either spent time or visited India, what makes India one of the most fascinating countries as an economist, it sort of simultaneously exists in the, what I would call the 17th century, the 19th century, and the 21st century, all at the same time, right? So you could go to places in Bangalore and New Delhi and Mumbai, or even in small, what are called class A towns that might feel like you're in a very first tier country, a world country's environment, and then you go away 50 miles and you feel like you've gone back three centuries. And how do you develop a country like that is one of the most challenging questions. And it's not an easy question. I think economists have written a lot, and it's tied up with politics and the social, cultural, institutional setup. And I don't think we have all the answers, nor should we think that we have all the answers. But I think the focus on markets, the focus on governance, and how we deliver the goods that people want is something that is absolutely fundamental. You know, half the Indian population is under 25. And I think at some point they don't remember the history, and they shouldn't. They should. There's a focus on jobs. There's a focus on quality education. There's a focus on what is considered aspirational. And I think, you know, the subtext of the BJP Modi's winning is much more because it sort of talks the game about we want to empower you rather than give you entitlements, which is what the last 5-7 years of the Congress-led UPA was all about, entitlements. And I think it is in those things that I think I see the glimmer of hope. In a traffic light analogy, I would give it a flickering green, maybe even if but not quite a red. That's what we were about 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I wouldn't give it a glaring green. I mean, it's too early. I mean, it's too early to judge the budget. There's been a lot written in the budget that was released last week. After all, the party has been in power for less than 2 months, or maybe just about. And the budget that was produced was a pretty decent budget. I mean, it's it puts everything that I've talked about. It sort of wants to empower the forces of marketization and economic conservatism and sort of unleashing the entrepreneurial abilities. All of it is sort of very good. It sort of increased the foreign direct investment in critical sectors such as defense and insurance, but it sort of stopped short of some of the political realities. So it's all pointing in the right direction, but I think we would want it, if you're sitting in California or the US, you would want India to succeed just because it is a big economic power and has a potential. On the world stage, it's still relatively small relative to, say, what's happening in China. But in terms of the connections to California, in terms of the business interests, we would want that very sort of crude economic ways that you want the economy to succeed. At a very fundamental humanistic story, the economy has to deliver. It cannot continue to grow at 5%, 6% with a population growth that's positive, greater than 1, because in real terms, then we are not really delivering the goods and services that is ultimately, fundamentally, why economies have to keep developing and have to keep growing. The last point that I think is very important, and it's something that I spent quite a bit of time recently doing some research on, is sort of what I would call the my worry is how do you develop a country that's as diverse as India? I mean, India is one of the most diverse economy. How will you measure diversity? Economically, culturally, regionally, politically, however you want to do it. And yet, you know, there are huge pockets, and these pockets are becoming bigger and bigger. But there's these huge pockets of what I would call, you know, what I've written somewhere else, islands of excellence, prosperities, and possibilities. So if you happen to be in one of those pockets, your life is relatively better off. But you have this surrounded by the sea of mediocrity, deprivation, and discontent. And how do you balance that in a democratic setting is an interesting story, especially when you want the country as a whole to develop. So when you think about the region around Delhi, when you think about Mumbai and Gujarat, and if you were to draw a diagonal, if you visualize the map of India, most of the states below the diagonal, for the most part, have done pretty well. And then you look at the Northeast, and you look at what was coined as the Bimaru states, the Bihar, the Madhya Pradesh, the UPs, and so on. But again, these are not, I don't want to draw generalization, because even within progressive states and high well-performing states in the south, like Tamil Nadu or Karnataka, which is like the Silicon Valley of India, there are pockets of India that go back three centuries, and there are pockets of India that go back 50 years ahead of where even we are today. And it's a challenge for chief ministers, it's a challenge for the policymakers of how do you balance this so that you're trying to get everybody up, so you're trying to address poverty, but then how do you make sure that inequality doesn't keep widening, because that creates other tensions. And ultimately, I think it's the belief that it comes back to, which is was there when the BJP was in power earlier on, it comes back to its belief in markets. You know, those who have lived in India know that the acronym LPG in India stands for liquefied petroleum gas. But the economists usually thinks of LPG as liberalization, privatization, and globalization. I would just replace P with marketization, because the problem with privatization is if I give the powers to a private monopoly, it doesn't necessarily do good. So I think what BJP and Modi in particular emulated with the Gujarat model, even though it led to the rise of big industries like Reliance, is the general focus on entrepreneurship and small innovations and competitiveness, which is what you would call marketization. So in some ways, I'll replace LPG with LMG. And I think the focus is really part of governance, and marketization is something that I think I will take away as what I think he's trying very hard. And I think we would want him as a citizen of India, as a citizen of the world, because you want this country to succeed. It doesn't mean that we want to have economic conflicts, but the flip side of 1/6 of the world's humanity failing is something we don't want to comprehend.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Hansen, you have done extensive research on communal conflicts and violence in India, and you're an expert on the broader phenomenon of Hindu nationalism. Some observers would argue that Mr. Modi and some of the members of his new government still have blood on their hands from the 2002 religious riots in Gujarat. How valid is this concern, and what should we expect from this new government in terms of Hindu-Muslim relations and the rights of minorities in India?
Well, thanks, David. This has been a very big issue in India the past year, also in the international debates. The term blood on his hands is, of course, a very loaded one, and let's be clear that there is no clear evidence that he ever gave an order to instigate a pogrom. I think the charge is that Mr. Modi let it happen. And inaction can be as lethal as action, as we know. So that's the charge. There is a whole lot of, there's been a big effort on part of the BJP to downplay this, to make it less significant, and I can see all the reasons why that is. There are a few facts that remain. One is that about a year after the events in 2002, where more than 1,000 people were killed, in fact, the numbers themselves have been down scaled, interestingly, over the past year. There used to be that we always said there was between 2,000 and 3,000. In the past year, it's been also on the web, it's been downscaled to 1,000, which in itself is a very interesting phenomenon. I cannot quite explain why that is. I leave that to the audience to think about that. But the fact is that about a year after that, Modi went on an election campaign, which he won resoundingly in Gujarat. And he actually traced in many ways the sites of major conflicts and where many of the killings had taken place. And he was campaigning in these places for Gujarati pride and so on and so forth. So this is a fact, this is an indisputable fact. It's something that there is a public record that says something about that there is not necessarily that Modi organized and orchestrated and ordered these killings to take place, but that the apparatus and the party as such and the wider movement that he was a part of was definitely implicated in it, and that the BJP also elected to take electoral advantage of the galvanization of a Hindu majoritarian sentiment that was generated by these events. So that's a fact. It's also a fact that was documented well in a report that was actually that came out from the Stanford Law School just the same week as the general election in India was held, that the judicial aftermath of the big riots in 2002 left a lot to be desired. It was a very, very problematic aftermath. It was so problematic that the Supreme Court of India intervened in the attempts to get people convicted of those who are culpable. That they recognized that people, that it was impossible to have due process and conduct some of these cases in Gujarat and move them to neighboring states in order to free the witnesses and the local judges and so on from undue pressure. So that in itself is another fact that also says something about the climate in Gujarat during the time. So when you say blood on the hands, well, it's not that simple, but it's also not as if it didn't happen, not as if there is no link, not as if you can say that this is a minor thing that really is not worth any attention. The reason why, what I find interesting in the wider context is the fact that in the elections, and also very much in the sort of rhetoric of many of Modi's supporters, both before the elections and after, it seems to be that that people have embraced indeed the idea of the strong man, a notion that I think has been very popular in India for a long time. I've worked in the state of Maharashtra, where Bal Thackeray, the recently deceased chief of the Shiv Sena, a sort of self-professed dictatorial leader, was immensely popular and was worshipped. And there are many examples of that throughout India, regional leaders who actually cultivate a sort of dictatorial image and people like it. So there is, Modi was tapping into this, but he was also able to actually tell the electorate and convince enough people that what happened in Gujarat was actually not very important. And for me, that's interesting and little disturbing in that you can say, well, so many people were killed, but we don't want to talk about it. Or people would say, well, they got what they had asked for, or we show the minorities their rightful place in India and so on and so forth. This is a sentiment that exists. It's not a new sentiment. It's a sentiment that grew throughout the 80s and 90s when the BJP was on the ascendant. And the reason why people are worried about Gujarat is not because of the Gujarat incidents and the carnage there in and of itself, but that the rise of the BJP and the wider Hindu nationalist movement has happened in conjunction with an unprecedented rise in the number of casualties in civil disturbances that are called communal riots in India. These are often attacks, these have been increasingly the last 20, 30 years, attacks by the majority community on the minority community that is mostly Muslims. And anyone who has studied, as I have done, and it's again for the public record, will know that the rise of the BJP, the rise of the Hindu nationalist movement in India, was entirely premised on the idea that the Muslim community minority was an internal threat to India, that they are an obstacle to India's development and prosperity, and so on and so forth. This is a sentiment that still exists, I would say. It's a sentiment that exists not among all the people who have been delivering the votes that, that Pradeep was talking about, but among the many millions of people who are members of the wider Hindu nationalist movement, many of whom feel that their time has come. We have now come to power. We have been a marginal force in India for a long time. Now our time has come. So these, I think, are indisputable facts. What will Modi mean for that equation? BJP has always maintained in whatever state that they, where they came to power, they always said, in the states ruled by us, there are never communal riots. There are no killings. Gujarat was an exception to that. And it's true that generally this has been something they have been going for. And I think in order to serve and deliver on all the promises that have been made and certainly deliver to all the very strong constituencies that have been stitched together successfully by Modi, they have to deliver social peace and civil order. So they will be quite vested in making sure that there are no major riots in India. And this is also what people in India, members of the Muslim community, have told me, that at least that's one good thing. We know that we will not be attacked in the way that we have been in the past. But having said that, it is also a fact, and this is not just due to the BJP, it's a fact, it's a long-term process in India that was documented in a high-profile report that was published in 2006 on the living conditions and general sort of prospect of the Muslim community in India, which is the largest minority in the world, religious minority in the world, 170 million people. That in on all, virtually all parameters, education, inclusion in the economy, inclusion in the public sector, wealth generation, bank accounts, you name it, Muslims are the worst off of all communities in the entire nation. They are worse off than Dalits, the former untouchables. This is a process that's been going on for a long time. I don't think that Modi and the BJP is interested in doing anything targeted to reverse that. I see no sign of that. In fact, the BJP has run, and Modi has run a campaign that was very much based on, we are Indians, we have to talk about national unity, we don't want to talk about caste and community differences, we want to work together and so on. And there was something very catchy and very appealing in that to many people, including many people from the lower caste. But in a society that is so deeply riven by differences, religious, social, and others, to decide not to talk about it and not to address these inequalities along these lines might be dangerous in the long run.
Thank you so much. I have collected enough questions from the audience to keep us here until about midnight tonight. They're all interesting questions, and they're all dealing with important topics, but it would not surprise you that the World Affairs Council membership is particularly interested in sort of the foreign policy dimensions of the new Modi government. And I have several questions here about what this new government might mean or might do vis-a-vis the Indo-Pak relationship. Questions about India's relationship with other neighbors in South Asia, India-China relationship, and of course the relationship between the United States and India. Sundar, could I invite you to just share any insights or thoughts? It's notable that foreign policy figured almost not at all in the campaign rhetoric or process, so it's really difficult to know what the mandate or the platform is. How would you assess the outlook in terms of any shifts or changes that we might expect in foreign policy from the new Modi government?
It's too early to tell, David. I think leading up to it and even some of the, you know, there was a lot of talk about, good talk about when he was inaugurated. This was the first time a prime minister of India had invited the heads of state of all the SARC, the South Asia Regional Cooperation countries, which meant, and the question is whether this is just pure symbolism or whether they'll actually, will India actually do something meaningful in terms of creating a true economic cooperation zone in South Asia, which has been in the works for a long time. The second text, a subtext, was that Modi had signaled and would signal a move towards the East, and by that, it's more pro-Japan, more pro-China, and ambivalence about the U.S. And that's interesting because, on the one hand, the U.S. business lobby leading up to the last 20 years was Gujarat was one of their darling states that was very attractive to the U.S. business interests. And yet Modi had been denied a visa multiple times to come to this country, but you can't do that to the Indian Prime Minister. And it'll be interesting whether Modi gets past it and looks towards the U.S. as a big player on the world stage and certainly has a huge role to play, especially as the U.S. interests diminish in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and so whether it realigns the business interests because India is a huge business potential for the U.S. And you know, right now, literally as we are speaking, the famous Doha round is supposed to be coming to an end, which is supposed to have come to an end, I don't know, 10 years ago. And India was one of the developing countries that, along with other developing countries, had really flexed its muscles. And I think there's a meeting coming up in Geneva one of these days, and the deadline is July 31st for India to get what it wants. And if it doesn't get what it wants, and that's an important one because that's a trade agreement that the world WTO has been wanting to finally get the countries to agree on. And it's some legitimate reasons from an economic standpoint that India and other developing countries like South Africa and Mexico and Brazil have had about agriculture and subsidies and so on, and how the U.S.-Europe relations on agriculture subsidies are vis-a-vis the Indian economy. So I think there are different levels, but I think in their manifesto and even in their initial stages, they have not made any conscious decisions, conscious signaling on what is the BJP foreign policy, if you want to call it that. I am not an expert in that, but nevertheless, I can't glean it, and I'm more curious about the economic policy as it relates to major partners, and that will be something I'll want to be much more interested in as a subset of the larger foreign policy question.
Yeah. Great, thank you. Pradeep, we have several questions from the audience about the role of corruption as a campaign issue. As you've mentioned, Mr. Modi campaigned on a promise of good governance, clean government, and this election came right on the heels of the Aad-Aadmi political movement, which didn't really turn out in significant force in the actual election itself, but represented a new movement in terms of the citizens' demand for an end to corruption. Is that something that you expect to see the new government attempt to address? And if so, in what ways would you envision them trying to tackle the endemic corruption that has been so significant a part of India's political setup?
I think there are two answers, two parts to that question. Let me take the first one. I have a somewhat contrary take. I don't think corruption mattered so much to the ordinary voter while making a decision in the election for a very simple reason. Most people, when they are facing corrupt officials are actually facing local level corruption. Most people are not concerned with corruption at the very highest level. Corruption in India is so deep and so endemic that people face it in their daily lives. And at that local level, it's very difficult to distinguish which party is better than the other, because often it is the politician whose job it is to circumvent the bureaucracy for you. So, you know, that's my take. I'm not so sure corruption mattered that much in deciding which party you would vote for. It's not that it's not an important issue for people, but you can't use as a basis for vote choice because you don't know which party is better on the ground. But it still remains a really large issue. And the question is, what is Mr. Modi going to do about it? And this is tough. I mean, what he's done so far is, you know, he started simple measures like people will come to the office on time. You know, governments will be, you know, the offices will be supposedly be clean. But are you actually going to be able to remove corrupt practices from the Indian bureaucracy and the lower levels of the Indian state, I think it's a much harder task. And my sense is the focus will be, there'll be a lot more rhetoric on it, but I think delivering clean government is a much more arduous task, and I don't know if I've seen any steps taken in that direction yet.
I want to approach the domestic policy agenda with an open invitation for any of our panelists. We have several questions about what initiatives we might expect in terms of India's environmental issues and challenges, reform of the educational system, effort to address the infrastructure needs and challenges. So I've got a significant stack here, and I would invite our panelists to pick and choose any of the kind of more the domestic policy side of the agenda for the new BJP government in whichever, through whichever angle you would like. Thomas, can we start with you?
Yeah, just briefly, I saw an announcement recently from the government saying that we want to start 100 new cities.
Smart cities.
Smart cities. And this whole, that's been, of course, debated in India now. You know, why do we need 100 new cities? What about upgrading the cities that we have and make them work better and so on and so forth? So I think there is a recognition, and this is not just, this is not BJP policy necessarily, that urbanization has to proceed in a different manner that's more organized and more also environmentally friendly. I think there is a lot of people who are pushing in that direction. The question is, again, not necessarily one of actual policies, but one of actual implementation, which is the weakest part of the Indian state. That you, saying in India is always, we have the best laws and the best policies in the world, but you know, they never come to nothing ever comes to fruition. So I think there is a recognition. It's likely that there will be a major push towards allocating more funds to urban development. But what urban development means depends entirely, I think, on what kind of economic development model that the government wants to push. If it wants to capitalize on the general model that has proven to work for India, which has been exploiting the higher end of the labor market, skills that are valuable in the global marketplace, then you would need one kind of cities. If you want to actually make India into the next industrial hub in the world, which is, I think, a possibility now that wages are going up in China and so on, you would need different kinds of cities. And I don't see that conversation happening at all in India, which is dismaying. So instead you have this sort of rhetoric of smart cities, which seems to be a continuation. We want more Bangalore, whatever. And those of you who have been to Bangalore will know that Bangalore is not a smart city, right? It has smart people in it, but it's not a smart city. So there is a lot of, I think, vacuous rhetoric going on. And I think the fundamental choice is, what kind of economic development model do we want? And that has to guide what kind of city we want.
Great. So, Sundar?
Picking up from that, right? So the problem of the three P's still remain in India, whether it's population, pollution, and poverty. And, you know, how we address it, I think, is very, very critical. But I think we have to be very realistic about the constraints the Modi government is starting with in terms of how much money the government actually has and how much money is it going to be able to raise, given the monsoons, given the oil prices, given the deficits, and all of that, right? So we have to adjust, temper the expectations of what is absolutely the next 12 months, 16 months, and then how do you get to that? And inflation is an issue, and the value of the rupees are still. So keep those constraints as we get into this discussion of infrastructure. I think most economists would address that this has been an issue that has, we have been underinvesting, and I distinguish between two kinds of infrastructure. There's these typical roads and ports and power and electricity grids and that kind of hard infrastructure or physical infrastructure. And then there's the second one, which is the social civic infrastructure, whether it's in terms of hospitals and dispensaries and clinics and schools and the civic infrastructure. And we've been underinvesting continually, if you go back in terms of share of investable dollars. Whether the government has the money in light of the constraints I mentioned earlier, or whether Modi, in my earlier comment about recognizing toffing the hat towards a public-private partnership and letting the private sector come in, and whether that's even possible, like we did with the airports in many of the cities that actually have become much better facilities than even 10 years ago. But I think the demand, I mean, it has to start with their infrastructure. Is one of the absolute fundamental investments that every country has to, and we are playing catch up. But it's maybe the most, if I could wave a magic wand and say this is the one sector, it'll be infrastructure to start with that. And it's not just the quantum of infrastructure, the dollars or rupees and trillions of rupees, it's the quality of the investment. And that gets to some of the questions you're asking about educational institute. What's the quality of the roads and what's the quality of the power grids so that Delhi doesn't have a blackout that lasts 2 hours, 2 days? And, you know, that's the second order, but it's equally important. And sometimes we worry about quantum rather than the efficacy or the quality. But you have to start somewhere. And you know, the last UPA government has really underinvested in a way that I think we got to turn the corner if India has to really aspire to something in the order of 6 to 7 to 8%. It's not going to happen without this.
Pradeep, anything that you would like to add in terms of the new government's domestic agenda?
I think as far as economic policy is concerned, I would agree with Sundar. I think they're going to focus on infrastructure, and they're also going to focus on, for good or bad, for good political reasons, for maybe for bad economic reasons, on gleaming infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's the idea of, you know, India shining in 2019.
A specific couple of questions for you, Pradeep, on the elections. One is the question about youth participation and whether you see the high turnout, particularly among younger voters, as an indication of an increased level of politics or political engagement on the part of the up-and-coming next generation of Indian voters and Indian citizens. And the second question has to do with whether the dynastic leadership on the Congress side was perceived as a liability, and in particular the characterization of Sonia Gandhi as not being of India, and you know, the implication of that in terms of the, you know, true nationalist roots of Congress.
Let me take the first question. I think there is good evidence that the younger voters turned out for the BJP in larger numbers. But would I call them politicized? I'm not so sure. I just think they were brought in because they felt that maybe Modi was a better option, or what Modi presented was a better option. For those of you who study American politics, how much Modi is responsible for Gujarat is like how much Dukakis was responsible for the Massachusetts miracle is something I'll let other economists figure out once they can figure it out. And I'll wait for the answer. But the fact is that a lot of people in India believed, and that's the really important thing to remember, is a lot of people in India believed that Gujarat was the model. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it's true or not, that's what they believed. And I think a lot of younger people believe that. So it's not they're more political, but just that they're thinking that this may be our best way forward. The second issue on the dynasty, I think the idea of Sonia Gandhi being a foreigner is, quite frankly, the appeal of that idea is very limited. Mm-hmm. I don't think it crosses beyond a certain small segment of society who would think that an Italian running the country is not okay. I don't think that goes that far. I think Modi did something which Indian politicians have never done before. And Indian politicians have never before, even in the BJP, openly attacked the dynasty. He went to Amethi, he went to the constituency where Rahul Gandhi was contesting from. He actually made purposely derogatory remarks about Rahul Gandhi. So for the first time, a BJP politician actually, so to use the American phrase, took the gloves off. And I think there are reasons for that. And the reasons are, then this is both the good and bad side of Indian democracy, that you have a low, for the first time, you have a local politician from the grassroots coming to power. And he is a very different kind of politician who understands the use of power, who knows what power means, and who will not hesitate to use it. And I think that's very different than the, what I would say, the urban Delhi intelligentsia, who maybe have this veneer of niceties about them. And but Modi plays really hardball politics, much like the Americans play. Mm-hmm. And I think in that sense, he's a good old-fashioned conservative politician. And he's not going to back down, as we saw in the case when he appointed to appoint his private secretary, he actually passed an ordinance, and then he made sure that Parliament approved it, because he appointed a former head of the Regulatory Authority of India as his private secretary. There was an anomaly in the law that the head of the telecom regulatory agency cannot be appointed to a government position. He made sure that the law was passed and all the regional parties came on board. So in other words, if you're going to play politics, we're going to play it like we play it in the US. We'll count every vote and we'll make it happen. So to me, that sounds like politics as usual.
Sundar, a number of the comments and questions relate back to the issue of environment and development. And we've seen an expression of interest in cleaning up Varanasi in terms of the pollution problems there. But as you think about the economic growth imperative and priority that the Modi government brings, how much emphasis or priority do you think environmental issues are likely to receive? And is there a balance in terms of their approach to sustainable growth and economic development?
You know, one, as you mentioned, my background, when I was at the Madras School of Economics, we had one of the National Centers of Excellence on Environmental Economics housed there. And what is most interesting and depressing part of my job was to meet with the minister every time who had no interest in the environment. And yet that was a portfolio of preserving the environment. But there was some reality, and that hasn't changed. And one of the things that he would tell me was that he, in cabinet meetings, is fighting with six other ministries whose every job is to extract from the environment, mines and power and coal. And so in some ways, I think the NGOs and the academic community and the civil society has been thinking about pollution and cleanup and urban issues and rural pollution and environmental issues more so than in some ways I would say even the government has been in the last 15, 20 years. And I don't see any departure from anything I've seen in the last 2 months from Modi's government. However, as India gets more and more entrenched and as globalization connects us in so many ways that we're sitting here, I know how the street in Bangalore looks like, I think the pressures are going to come from within as the Indian people want to lead a cleaner environment or want the environment to get cleaned up. And environment is one of those things that gets hit from both sides of the income spectrum. Poor people do unsustainable environmental practices in a way that harms the environment. And when they become richer and richer, they create a different kind of what is called affluenza, where affluent people take more and more from what the environment offers. So in some ways, I think it requires a very nimble but very focused attention on the environment. Now there's some history in Gujarat itself. If you remember, in the mid 90s, there was the plague in the city of Surat, which was a big diamond city. And when you go back now to Surat, they managed to clean up in a way but it was a shock to the system that forced it. Whether the Ganges will get cleaned up, there have been God knows how many policies and tribunals that spent money, and whether this most sacred river will actually get cleaned up remains to be seen. But as I said, jokingly, when I said the three P's, pollution is the middle of the three, population, pollution, poverty, it is high time that it's not just at the ministerial level, but at the state level, and it starts with civic bodies really taking, what do we mean by cleaning up the environment? I mean, it's become you know, it's something that we have really neglected much more than we have neglected many other areas. So I do think the environmental issues, not just from a resource standpoint, but also from the pollution standpoint, is something that needs to be addressed. But, you know, he has not really spoken about it, and whether he will or not is an interesting question.
Thomas, I'm going to turn to you to comment a little bit, if you would, on the connection between the Hindu nationalist rhetoric that's playing for a domestic audience and what that's likely to mean in terms of India's relationship with Pakistan and what the Modi government's attitude and approach is likely to be in terms of efforts to, you know, address longstanding conflicts and disputes between these two big neighbors.
Well, I mean, there is the idea in Pakistan that dealing with the Hindu nationalists is a little bit easier because we know what they stand for. But also the perception that Congress always stood for more or less the same thing, but never said that. So I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, the old wisdom about, you know, Republicans make better foreign policy, a more lasting foreign policy, because they don't try to be nice. I don't know. I mean, I think India is in a much stronger position now to actually move constructively on the India-Pakistan relationship. But it's the equation has changed so much that the India, and in some ways the gesture of inviting Sharif and the other heads of state was also, in a way, was read, of course, partly in parts of the Pakistani press, also as a kind of gesture of domination, right? So now the Badshah has returned, right? The emperor has returned, and Delhi is again the center of everything. So there is, at one level, I think, a reading that in Pakistan that is, well, it's a known entity. We know that this government will play hardball. There is perhaps a real opportunity here. On the other hand, the question is what's happening in Pakistan internally is a much more complicated issue now than it was 20 years ago, because the Pakistani state is getting weaker and weaker by the day. So the balance that we've been used to think about India and Pakistan as a kind of parity, two nation states with nuclear weapons and all that, it's still true, but inside these states, very different things are happening. So I think there's a complicated thing. I think that the challenge for Modi is not to overplay, as it were, the strength card, and not try to, in a sense, bully Pakistan into something, which they he both domestically in India, but also in terms of the relative both economic and military strength, he would be able to. So I think, in this field, as in fields of cultural politics and other fields, his main challenge is, in a sense, to keep the hardliners at bay and rely on a sort of gradual process. And one hopes something positive will happen. Maybe there are better chances this time. I wouldn't be surprised if some sort of thaw could happen.
Interesting.
But as long as it's not about Kashmir, I think. Everything else is negotiable. Kashmir has to be
economic relations.
That's right. You have to insulate, put that aside, and then we can talk about everything else. That would be the smart. But it's
great.
Very difficult,
great.
Even on a good day.
We have just a couple minutes for concluding thoughts, and I would like to pose a question to each of our panelists. Mr. Modi, a successful chief minister, chief executive of Gujarat, successful campaigner. Can he, over the next 5 years, be a successful prime minister? Pradeep, your thoughts.
Depends on how you define successful. That's a good academic answer. You know, it's called the famous dodge. But I think so far he's done all the right moves. He's made all the right moves politically. And I think a lot will be seen in the coming years, because even in Gujarat, he took a couple of years to settle down and put a stamp. But I think so far in the first 2 months, His political moves have been actually very good.
Sundar?
Normally it's economists who say it depends, but you stole my line. I would have to agree. I'm actually very cautiously optimistic. based on the track record, based on the 2 months. And I think the next 5 years I'm actually less concerned about. It's the next term when he gets elected, when he feels emboldened, and that's where I would think about whether some of the concerns that Tom mentioned would actually come back. I think he would behave in the next 4 or 5 years, the reality, the ground realities of economics and politics being that he would have to.
Thomas?
Yeah, I think he will have a decent shot at least serving the community or the constituency that brought him to power. And that's what he will be focused on. His main challenge will be to make sure that those guys who helped him win the election across the nation, who are not members of his core movement, will stay loyal to him over the next 3-4 years. Knowing India a little bit, I highly doubt that's because it's a game. It's a kind of you always go for a likely winner, whether it's in a local context or a national context. So as long as he looks like a winner and he is decisive and he does all this stuff, and he's likely to pull off quite a few changes, not necessarily changes that will be good for a lot of the people who were worried about Modi or who didn't vote for him or belong to those groups of society that he never targeted, but he will try to serve that constituency, and that is the decisive constituency in India. But I think it will produce perhaps a slightly more unequal India, perhaps a more prosperous India, but also a more unequal India.
We will take these as signs of hope in terms of the initial phase of the new Modi government. I want to invite you to join me in thanking our three distinguished panelists, Pradeep Chibber, Thomas Hansen, and Sundar Ramaswamy. Thank you very much for joining us.